All right, welcome back to Defrag. This is episode 8, and this is my good man, Gove. Gove, how you doing?
I'm good. How about you, Larry?
Couldn't be better. So we've got a ton of questions today. We're just going to dive right down into it. We've got a couple that are just, they aren't so much troubleshooting, it's just really good questions. So we're going to start there. In Windows 7, there's two folders. One of them is called Program Files, and the other is called Program Files x86. What is the difference between them?
Okay, so when, you know, 64-bit was first coming along, one of the main goals was to ensure compatibility and so that people would not have to do a lot of recompilation and would not have to do a bunch of changes in order for them to move to 64-bit platforms.
Yeah.
So what they wanted to do was say, you know what, people should just be using environment variables, you know, the percent program files. And by default, 32-bit applications will get the... will get redirected.
Yeah.
And that's what the program files x86 directory is for. It's essentially to say, you know, everything that's 32-bit goes there. And those legacy 32-bit applications wouldn't have to worry about, you know, in reality, what the actual program folder name is. It was also to ensure that if you had both a 64-bit and a 32-bit application installed that was the same app on the same machine, that they wouldn't interfere with each other.
They're in different places.
They're in different
Keep
places.
Separated.
Right. So essentially the native version, you know, whatever architecture that that application was compiled for, x86 or x64, always goes into the program files directory.
Yeah. So let's say I've got a 32-bit app, and I'm installing it, and I forget and just install it in program files.
It normally wouldn't allow you to do that, because what we do is we detect the fact that it's a 32-bit application.
Yeah.
And it may try to say, I want to go to program files, but it won't actually. It'll get redirected automatically to the x86 folder. Now, there are, of course, ways for a 32-bit application, if it is self-aware of it being on a 64-bit platform, it can bypass all of those with particular API settings, and it can actually install itself into program files.
Yeah.
Now, for the most part, if it's a very self-contained application, it should be fine. But if it is, say, a process that installs itself and it works with other processes on the system or other applications on the system, other applications may be confused of where these files are. So what you wouldn't normally want to do is install a 32-bit application into program files on a 64-bit system if it was installing plugins, for example.
Yeah.
That may cause you issues.
Okay. All right. So for the most part, though, you don't have to worry about it. Just let it install where it's going to install.
Exactly. We generally don't like to tell users when they're installing software to deviate from the defaults.
Yeah.
Only because the defaults are what's well tested.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and if it defaults in the installation, the program probably looks there too. So
exactly.
Just let it go where it wants to go, and
right.
It should be fine. Cool. Okay. All right. So next question that we have: what are some of the things that we can do to a Windows 7 home theater PC to tweak it to make it work better?
Okay, so normally speaking, when you have a home theater PC, it's kind of dedicated. You know, you have it hooked up to a television.
Yeah.
You might have a keyboard and mouse, but, you know, you're the 10-foot on the couch kind of thing. You know, you're 10 feet away. You're not really interacting with it as a computer. It's just really playing movies or music or whatever. So what I tend to do is I set Media Center to start automatically with the OS. It's in the options of Media Center. It can actually... show you that right now. We'll actually see what this does
we'll
to the
see
overall.
We'll see what a 2.1 Windows Experience Index machine does with Media Center firing up on it.
Oh, look at this. I've actually never...
What, you never used this netbook for Media Center?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, huh? Okay, good. So we just go into the task, go to general, startup and window behavior. I always set it to keep Media Center on top.
Yeah.
So you don't have weird notification dialogues coming up and bothering you.
Yeah.
And start Media Center when Windows starts.
Cool.
Those two basically are all that you need. What you'd also want to do is set up... automatic updates to not notify, just go ahead, do its thing, reboot it.
Yeah.
Your system really shouldn't have any effect. Another thing that I like to do, Media Center boxes, at least mine, are based on Atoms. Mm-hmm. So they're relatively low end because they don't need to do a whole lot.
Yeah.
With the NVIDIA Ion, so it does most of the heavy lifting. What I like to do is use a ReadyBoost drive to help augment the speed of the system. So nice. I just have like a dumb 4 gig thumb drive permanently stuck in the machine.
Yeah.
Works really, really well.
Nice.
And the hard drive that I have on the system is, you know, just a standard 7200 RPM, I think Hitachi drive, 500 gig.
Yeah.
Very, very basic system.
What about processes and services?
I do. I don't tend to turn off too many because the system as is comes pretty bare bone.
Yeah.
But you can do things like, you know, turn off group policy. You could turn off the print spooler. I mean,
yeah.
Frankly, most people will never print
from your TV.
Exactly. So you'd probably, you know, want to leave most things alone because anything that is manual start more than likely won't be used too often.
Yeah.
Things that are automatic start, for example, those might be some things that you want to turn off. Offline files might be one. Remote registry would be another. You wouldn't want to turn off things like, shell hardware detection or the task schedule, don't turn off that one, or user profile service, don't turn off that one.
Mm-hmm.
You'd want to leave basically the rest alone. Basic system for Media Center, especially a home premium box, is going to be pretty pared down.
Yeah.
If this is a box that you've purchased from an OEM, you might want to go through and clear out some of the applications that gets pre-installed on the system. A lot of stuff tends to start up with the system.
A little deboning, like you do on a new machine.
Yeah.
Take some of that out, yeah.
Yeah, I'd still, especially if it's connected to the internet in any way, shape, or form, still want to have the basic anti-spyware. When Microsoft Security Essentials is nice and basic and bare bones, pretty unobtrusive.
Yeah.
Perfect for a home theater system.
Nice. Cool. Okay. All right. So next question. We've got someone who has a 1 terabyte hard drive and a 40 gig SSD.
Mm-hmm.
Tried using the 40 gig SSD. It's just a little too small. I've noticed this too. I mean, 40 gig is small to have your core operating system, and then you always forget and hit enter, and you've installed like, you know, the Adobe Suite or something on there, and now you're just completely out of space. So they're wondering, should they get rid of the 40 gig and get a 120 gig SSD, or should they buy another 40 gig similar drive and use it in RAID 0? Or should they take the 40 gig drive and use it as a ReadyBoost drive? Because they want Windows to boot quickly, and they'd like their other applications like Photoshop to respond as quickly too. And will that give them a performance improvement? What would be your suggestion there?
Depending on the age of the drive, I'd probably just go with the 120 gig.
Yeah, just get a new one.
Get a new one and use that. Your system will always be the fastest if the OS is on the SSD drive.
Yeah.
It might be actually cheaper, or it might just be more fun to try it out and get another 40 and do a RAID 0.
So you can do a RAID 0 with SSDs?
Oh, sure.
And it seems dangerous, a little dangerous, because
anytime RAID 0 is used as your primary system, it is dangerous.
And there seems to be, and maybe this is just my own bit getting flipped on this, but there seems to be that SSDs have, it's a new technology, and sometimes there's issues with them.
As with any technology, as with any hard drive, regardless of SSD or spinning drive, you always want to have good backups.
So, yeah, if you do a couple of 40 gigs in RAID 0, no redundancy.
There's no redundancy.
You're throwing dice.
Yes, absolutely.
Keep good backups,
Key
thing there.
The other thing is that if this is just about raw performance of your OS, you want fast boot up, fast shutdown, fast applications, then you might just move all your data off of the RAID system onto something else. Mm-hmm. You can take a complete PC backup once you've got everything configured, and then frankly it doesn't matter if it goes down, because you can just restore it back,
and it'll be fast because
it'll always
store an SSD. So.
Exactly.
Cool. Now let's talk a little bit about taking that 40 gig drive and using it as a ReadyBoost drive.
Mm-hmm.
So ReadyBoost is only going to use a small amount of that drive.
Infinitesimal amount, really, when you consider. I believe you can max out a ReadyBoost as 4 gig.
Yeah.
So you could always partition up the drive to be, you know, part of the first part of it being the 4 gig ready boost drive, partition the rest of it as, say, swap access.
Yeah.
You know, you could always do something like that. But the thing to remember is that you're still accessing that drive as a single pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even if the first part of it is ready boost, the second part of it is data, if you're hitting both of them at the exact same time, you still have to deal with the bus contention.
A little bit of perf issues there. But you could plug in that drive, set it up as ready boost, and then take Photoshop or Premiere or something and just say, this is going to be my swap file too.
Sure.
Now, what about that kind of thrashing on that drive? Is that going to be a problem because it's an SSD, or would it be a problem for any drive?
It is a problem for the SSD just for the number of write cycles that it has, so
yeah.
You'd want to make sure that the drive supports trim.
Yeah.
And frankly, if you are just dealing with it as temporary space, you might not worry about it as much as blocks get marked bad and it gets moved over.
Mm-hmm.
You'll just find that your overall size will continue to shrink.
Is there a way to fix that, or is that just...
No, once they're bad, they're bad.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to buy a new one. But if you're not too caring about the data consistency, or if it's always temporary files that are on there, you don't actually care about the true data. I mean, obviously it would be bad if you have corrupt data on it, but you can always say, you know, if you partition it up and you say, you know, the first part of it is ready boost, and I'm going to do, say, a 10-gig partition, and then you use up that 10-gig, you keep going to the next 10, 10, 10,
mm-hmm.
and use up the drive in that manner.
Very cool. Interesting. Okay. All right, so next question. Windows Explorer, when I do a Windows E and start up Windows Explorer, it shows up with the libraries expanded on the left. Is it possible to have Windows Explorer start with a specific open tree viewable on the left?
It is unfortunately not possible to do it with the Windows key E
yeah.
combination, but it is actually relatively simple to do this with other keyboard combinations. And in fact, I kind of prefer doing it in this particular manner because then you can set up multiple folders.
Show me how you would do it.
Okay, so what I've done is, start up Windows Explorer. So goes to the libraries, right?
Okay.
But let's say you want it to be, perflogs.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to right click, drag it to my desktop, and say create a shortcut, and then go to the properties of that shortcut and say give it a keyboard shortcut key. So Control Alt, say U.
Okay.
In fact, I've created another one earlier to this resources folder here, and its shortcut key is Control T.
Okay.
So then what you do is you right click, drag the folder that you just created on the desktop down to your taskbar, pin it, and then it shows up in this main icon here, and you have...
So that's your Windows Explorer icon that shows up on the taskbar anyway because you have it pinned to it. And now you've got a jump list that'll show you all the shortcuts that you wanted to have.
Right.
That's even better.
And I can go to any of them, so Control-T and Control-U, and apparently I don't have permission to these ones because it's a detected folder.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Yeah, sure.
Now it's there. You can get to it via the keyboard combinations, or, you know, you can go to it from your pin list.
Very cool.
I do like the pin list a lot. I use this relatively frequently.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, next question. So in Windows 7, if you grab a window and shake it back and forth to minimize it, they do this by accident too much and they want to stop doing that. How do you turn that off?
Oh, you mean this? Doesn't everybody like this?
Well, you do. You got to have more than one window, though.
You got to have more than one window. Okay. Let's see. Start up. You mean that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's such an awesome feature, though.
How could you not love that?
Exactly.
Maybe if you're just a little shaky to begin with.
Oh, I suppose.
And when you grab windows and move them around, you're minimizing everything.
That's true. Or if you're, you know, too
night
super
out
speedy.
On the town, you're feeling a little wobbly the next day.
You're drunk very often.
I didn't say that. I just, you know, just night out on the town. Just very general. So how can we turn that off?
Oh, the wonderful group policy.
Excellent.
So you start this by going to gpedit.msc. Let's just run. I have it here. I've already got it running.
Okay.
You navigate to the user configuration, administrative templates, desktop. And it has a whole bunch of options here.
So you could do a lot of things here.
You can do a lot of things. This is, you know, generally designed for enterprises to push out certain policies for their users or for the computers.
And this is on every SKU of Windows?
GP Edit is not on the home editions, unfortunately.
Okay.
Generally speaking, though, the policies behind them are still relevant. So
yeah.
if you went to Bing and searched on the policy that you were looking for, you
yeah.
could manually enter them.
So you can get around that if you have to.
If you have to, yeah.
yeah.
So the particular option is the turn off arrow shake window minimizing mouse gesture. Wow, that is very verbose.
It's a Microsoft name.
It's a very yeah. much Microsoft name.
You're lucky it doesn't have Ultimate in there, a couple other things as well.
I'd actually recommend, you know, for people to use GP Edit as opposed to using the registry editor
yeah.
for doing their policies, because it's much easier to undo.
Yeah,
you know, you don't have to remember necessarily. Oh, what was a particular value that I need to reset it to? You know, just go through the UI, because you know, as time goes on, it is definitely possible for the underlying mechanism for which the how the policy is set to
yeah.
change,
yeah.
but the UI will stay the same. So this is our main interface, and we prefer users to use this interface.
Excellent. Okay. All right. So that is the supported way to do this, then.
Right.
Very good.
What you'll want to do, just to make sure that everything applies, is after setting this policy, reboot the machine.
Mm-hmm.
That way, it's ensuring that the policy is going to be set.
All right. And so now you can go out power drinking and not have to worry about minimizing everything in the morning.
That's true, except if you do this while you're... After you've been drinking, you might forget that you've done it, and then you'll wonder
that's true.
Why it doesn't
why
work.
Why doesn't it work, and you'll just be shaking windows all day.
Exactly. So leave a note to yourself.
yeah.
Along the same lines, you know, keep a tally of the different policies that you set, because over time,
yeah.
you might find that a policy that you set a year ago is actually interfering with something that you're doing today.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's always a really, really good idea to keep note of the changes that you've made to your system when mm-hmm. you've made it, so you know how to go back and undo them.
Cool. Okay. Good advice. All right, so next question. This is an interesting one. So I have a wireless router at home.
Mm-hmm.
It has looks like a Russian fishing trawler with all the antennas coming out of the top of it. How do I know how to set up all those antennas to get the maximum reach in my house?
Besides reading the manual?
Besides reading the manual.
Oh,
and the manual might not even say that in there.
That's true.
We're going off the assumption that it's in a ground floor of a house, and most of the wireless use is on the second floor of the house on the far side.
Okay. So generally what you'd want to do is just point the antennas straight up.
Yeah.
But really this is the kind of thing that is about finding the maximum coverage that you can do in your own home. So in a lot of cases, that isn't a straight-up antenna.
Yeah.
You know, you might have to bend it in a lot of different ways. But your real question is, how do I find that?
Yeah.
What I've done in the past is purchased some cheap Wi-Fi finders.
Yes.
So you can get them on a keychain kind of
yeah.
thing. You don't have to do this. Other methods are, you know, just taking a computer and bringing up the, you know, the view available networks and the signal strengths involved.
Yes.
What you can do then is just attach to it, and as you walk around the house, if you actually bring up the property status, yeah, so you could actually take a look at the signal quality and the speed, because
mm-hmm.
that's also really important. You can have high signal quality but low speed only because of the way that it's stepped in the power.
Yeah.
So you want to find the maximum speed, maximum signal, walk around your house and check that out while having somebody else change the antenna
mm-hmm.
position, be on the phone, walkie-talkie, whatever, or even instant messenger.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a method. I think you came up with an interesting method.
So this is the method that I used, and it was mainly because I had an Xbox that was using a wireless connection very far away from my router, and so I wanted to make sure that the Xbox itself was configured to get the fastest speed, not necessarily, you know, a netbook or something like that. So in Xbox, when you set up a wireless network, there's a network performance tuning
mm-hmm.
section in there. So you can bring it to that, and then it shows a signal strength, how good or bad any given signal is, and then get the wife on the phone by the router with the antennas and just say start adjusting one antenna at a time, and then see which ones you end up with a better signal on the Xbox. Given that wireless thing, you could also use a netbook or something else, anything that will show you how strong wireless signal is, and adjust it that way.
Did you, on your router, did you have removable antennas?
Not that I know of.
Oh, okay, so they weren't like the BNC style connectors, the threaded
I'm
kind.
I'm sure they probably unscrew, but I haven't done that. On mine, I've got the Linksys wireless gaming router, so it's mm-hmm. one with the tattoo on the side. So it's got two that, you know, come off the sides that, you know, kind of either go out or up a little bit. Has two on top and then a big paddle on mm-hmm. the top too. How do you set the paddle? Who knows?
How do you set the paddle? No.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a huge range of motion there either.
No. Yeah.
The only other suggestion that I would do is get a couple of external antennas, or longer range extendable antennas.
Yeah.
And then, you know, plug those in and move them further out or further up
mm-hmm.
In order to increase your coverage. Because remember, you know, you have a concentrated spot that's trying to, you know, service everything. It might have to output more power required
yeah.
just because it's in this one central location, as opposed to like extending your antennas out and, you know, better supplementing the coverage.
Yeah, and by extending your antennas, you're just making a longer antenna to begin with, so it's probably going to
yes.
give you a little bit better performance anyway.
Yeah.
Good, excellent. All right, so you've got something you want to talk about today.
I did. I wanted to talk about compatibility
mm-hmm.
and how you can discover and get some additional information on the types of compatibility issues and how to solve your own compatibility issues. So I think a lot of people have seen the program compatibility assistant
yeah.
dialog come up. You know, they install a piece of software, it either doesn't work correctly or what have you, you cancel out of it, and the dialog comes up saying, you know, would you like to apply specific settings?
Yeah.
And then rerun the application. You go, sure, but you don't really know what those settings are, right? So what you can do is go into the registry, go to HKLM Software Microsoft, Windows NT, current version, App Compat Flags, Compatibility Assistant. They are going to be set in here for the different types of compatibility layers that are applied to an application. So this is one location. The other thing that you can do is, say for example, you needed to apply particular compatibility layers. I went by this one actually kind of quickly.
Yeah.
This is the compatibility tab for Windows. You can set different...
So it's any given icon for a program that you have on your computer.
Yeah.
You can right-click on that icon, go to the properties, and then you'll have a compatibility tab.
Right. And you can tell to run that application a particular compatibility mode.
Yeah.
You know, so say I wanted to give that particular application the XP compatibility mode. What's interesting about a compatibility mode is it's actually a collection of shims. They're called shims. So what gets applied is a layer, and as part of that layer are a bunch of shims. If you wanted to figure out, you know, what is actually in those layers to help tailor it, because when you apply something with the XP mode, you have things like the XP version lie, you have a whole bunch of additional shims that are applied that you may not actually need.
Yeah.
So what you can do is take a look in this area again. And let's see. Probably make this go into the 32-bit node, because that's a 32-bit application. Where are you?
So are you not seeing it because you didn't click on OK to tell it that
you
wanted?
Did I not click on OK?
No, you did.
You know why? Because I looked in the... I'm looking in the HKLM
mm-hmm.
area. There we go. There's the layers key. Okay, so it has this WinXPSP3 layer.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, that actually covers a lot of different shims. What you can do is go to the internet and download something called the Windows Application Compatibility Toolkit. Mm-hmm. What you want to do is download this, the actual toolkit setup, and start it by going here and Compatibility Administrator, 32-bit or 64-bit. My system is a 64-bit system, so it can... There's different databases for 32-bit apps and 64-bit apps. So when you take a look at that, it'll actually bring up this UI, and you can crack the entire database of every app that we have ever specifically shimmed.
Wow.
In Windows. So
someone's gone through and actually looked at all these apps to see what type of environment they need to run best?
Well, yes, essentially. Like, these are apps that we've tested for, you know, the past decade, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there's been some problem or the other associated with it. And we've had to apply mitigations, essentially.
Yeah.
So some of them are very specific mitigations. Some of them are generic mitigations. But this Explorer essentially will tell you all the different things. Like,
so if I install Army Men 2, it automatically will use the right environment and the right shims?
Exactly. So
what we
did is, you know, we have shims like Windows 95 version lie.
Yeah.
This is a really, really old game, apparently.
Yeah, I remember this game. This is the old Army Men first one.
So we have all of these different mitigations applied.
Yeah.
Now, remember I was saying before how to take a look at what is in the XPSP3 layer. How to do that would be to create a new compatibility custom database.
Mm-hmm.
This is one way to take a look at them. The other way is by looking at compatibility modes. So the when XPSP3 has all of these specific shims.
Cool, okay.
Now what you can do is create a new fix for a specific application. You know, if I wanted to create a new application fix, you know, just call it Product Studio, point it to wherever that particular app is.
Is it in program files and not x86?
Yeah, no, actually, this one is right here. And what you can do is run it in a particular mode,
mm-hmm.
or you can skip all of these layers, go to next, and here are all the individual shims.
Nice.
That you can do.
So you can do just the ones that you need.
Just the ones that you need. So, you know, you can say, well, I don't need all of the other stuff. All I need is, say, a WinXP SP3 version lie.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all that I need. And then you could create that fix. You know, this is what we call matching information.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to apply it to anything that's just called ps.exe.
Yeah.
You can pick and choose all the things that make it relevant. You can add other files to match against.
Mm-hmm.
Then you just say finish, and you can install that database. Save it first, I suppose. We're going to save it to the desktop. So you can see that right here, TestSDB. We can install that from here. And it will also show up in add remove programs. So it's right there.
Nice.
So you can actually create fixes for yourself. You can install them on your machine, create them for different applications. You can save them off. You can, you know.
And if you have problems, you can uninstall it.
And if you have problems, you can uninstall it. This is one of those things. It's like being very careful about what you set up on your machine and being able to roll back. This makes life a lot simpler.
Nice.
That was the quick and dirty rundown on the compatibility administrator. I recommend people take a look, what's in there.
Yeah.
Take a look at, this is just a small fraction.
I want to look through and find all the old games that I have that now I know they'll run on Windows 7. Go ahead and reinstall some of these.
Well, remember, this is not necessarily for Windows 7. These are all of the fixes that we've ever done for any OS.
Oh, really? Yeah.
That still exists for Windows 7.
Rainbow Six. Yeah. Now we're talking. All right.
The other cool thing is, let's say you're having an older game, and you're wondering, I wonder if that's shimmed or if one of these mitigations is causing a problem with that game.
Mm-hmm.
You can take a look at it and say, let's see, what do we got? Okay, so we picked this one, right?
Radmin, yeah.
Radmin. You can actually right-click on this and say disable the entry.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can start troubleshooting, if any of the particular fixes might be interfering in your particular scenario. So test it out with no shims. Now, most of the time, or 99.99% of the time, these mitigations are actually required. But depending on your scenario, your environment, it may actually be causing an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one way of troubleshooting and to take some factors out of the equation.
Excellent. Awesome. Okay. So then the last thing that we have for today is someone that we're working with a problem on who sent us an email. Which, by the way, if you have any issues that you need help with, you can just email us at defragshow@microsoft.com. Happy to get back to you. We're probably going to need a lot more information depending on what the problem is.
Yeah.
We'll go back and forth with you. Gove will anyway. I like to take a little bit of credit for that, but I just kind of watch from the side.
Well, at least you're keeping track.
Yeah. So we have Craig who had written us with the subject line, "I really enjoy watching the show," which is the best way to get a fast response from us. So he had a mouse's sluggish issue, and he had some stuttering in audio playback that's mm-hmm. about 4 months old on these problems.
Mm-hmm.
You walk through what with the mouse issues?
So for the basic stuttering issues and the sluggish mouse, it's kind of like, well, he had a wireless mouse.
Yeah.
So the number one cause of stuttering issues for wireless mice are low batteries.
Yeah, yeah.
And most people actually kind of forget about the batteries.
Yeah, yeah.
So told him to swap them out. That apparently wasn't the actual issue. With a wired mouse, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm.
He had a bunch of other software on his system. So unless the problem actually started when he first attached the mice, and he actually said that it didn't in this particular case, it seemed like it was going to be something that happened afterwards or something interfering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, usually when you have some sort of stuttering, it means there's something, CPU intensive. Something is taking time away from the mouse to actually respond correctly.
Yeah.
So we have to try and figure out, well, what does he have installed on the system that's causing, this sluggishness? Now, you can do this in a number of different ways. You're getting a perf trace is the best method, of course,
mm-hmm.
for sluggishness. Another method is just to, take a look at what's installed. He gave an output of Windows Media Player, all the different codecs and all the different DLLs that were installed on a system at the time.
Yeah.
That this was happening. He was seeing a bunch of these problems playing MP3s and WMAs with Media Player. So based on that output, one of the apps that I found was Trillion. And after uninstalling...
The Events DLL.
Events DLL. It's kind of suspicious. Every time I see third-party DLLs loaded into a system process,
mm-hmm.
you just kind of have to wonder what it's doing. Things in Media Player, for example, should only have codecs installed, video and audio codecs. So when other DLLs are injected into the process, you have to start to wonder, well, what are they doing? Why are they there?
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically when I suggested, start uninstalling those applications. And Trillion you know, it was
kind of... want to throw them under the bus, but it was
the one that came to mind. It's like something called Events DLL. What is it doing? Is it filtering
looking
on things? Looking for events.
Might be doing that too much.
Right.
Yeah. So you took that out, that fixed the mouse problem, and we're still working on some of the stuttering problems in audio is fixed, but we're still working on some others.
Exactly.
Right. We'll keep bringing you updates on that.
For his particular issue and for pretty much everyone's issue, if you buy, you know, an OEM system and it's not working correctly right from the get-go, you know, that's at least something to think
problem
about.
Problem one.
Problem one.
Yeah.
But if it's something that's developed over time, you know, what have you installed? Can you go back in time? Most OEM systems come with a restore disk. Go back to the restore disk. Take it back to a clean state.
Now, would you ever try, like, just restoring a restore point from a little bit earlier? Like he said, it was a four-month problem. Maybe go back to about 4 months ago if you have it?
If you can, if you're willing to take, you know, the risk to go back in time like that. Generally, what I would like to do is, you know, back up the system, back up the data, because for any kind of restore, you don't necessarily know for 100% certainty that you're going to be okay with that restore.
Yeah.
So the more changes that you then apply or undo, so to speak, just takes you into a new state.
Nothing beats a flattening.
Nothing beats a flattening. Yeah. You know, the restore disk is great because at least it takes it back to a known baseline.
A standard
straight clean install is, of course, best, but not a lot of people can do that, especially with OEM systems where they don't have the DVD.
Yeah.
The restore disk is the only way to go back to a known baseline.
Awesome. Well, that's the show for this week. Again, if you have any questions and you want to write us, it's defragshow@microsoft.com. Let us know in there if you prefer to stay anonymous or if you want to use your name on the air. And, yeah, watch us here on Channel 9. See you next time.
Take a look at the Compat Toolkit. It's really cool.
Take a look at the Compat Toolkit for sure.